now the cash money in the spot. I can get the
300 Quaker probably in the spot. I'm going to do.
They steal the door. They turn it to cash.
Okay, I'm on the northbound access. Trying to delay.
What's that thing, Carl? What's the house going to do? And I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome back, folks, to this maybe the final episode. We're not too sure. I think it probably is. We'll keep it going and finish this off. It's the exciting and horrifying and exhilarating ride of Martin J. McNally from Detroit to St. Louis to the Skyjack plane to Tulsa to back to to St. Louis, back up around the air to Peru, Indiana, back to Detroit, and then back to St. Louis for trial. I know you've been listening to this by all the way up to now, and I just told you the story. Martin J. McNally's right here in the studio with us, although we're not really in the studio. We're at what we call an offsite in another city. We had to travel to interview him. He served, 32 years?
37.
37 years in the penitentiary for this and got released a couple, 3 years ago. And he was Googling his name one night, and he found that first two episodes we did on this when I first learned of this story. And we thought it was such an interesting story, and he liked what we did, and he commented on my website page a couple times after each episode and gave me his email, was kind enough to give me his email and invited us to come and hear his side of the story and straighten out some of the places where I got it wrong. And I did get it wrong a few times. So we're here. We're going to straighten that out with the words out of the mouth of the guy that did it, which you just can't beat that, folks. You cannot be that. So
I don't know who else is doing that.
Say hello, Aaron. I didn't say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Say hello, Mac.
Hello, Mac.
We found out we were doing a remote where we interviewed Craig Glazier, who's the author of The King of Sting, where he was subsequently arrested before the book for ripping off drug dealers for their drugs and money. And a gal who apparently is a fan of Gangland Wire crime stories was there for the live podcast, came up to us afterwards and said, "We didn't do the hello, Aaron."
She liked that.
Turns out that's one of her favorite parts of the show. It's me just saying hello, Aaron.
And I thought it was me.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, let's get back into this. We've been working at this all day long, and we're all tired. I know I am.
I knew this was going to be a long day because
Mac is.
It's such a phenomenal story.
I mean,
it just goes, and we don't want to run out of tape. We're taping off of four different devices here just so we can make sure that we don't lose any of this.
Right.
Because you don't really get the words from the mouth of the man that did it very often.
Not very often.
And he's definitely given us a gift to come forward and tell his side of this story.
Before I die.
And I think people should hear it because, you know, this was 2015 when we started doing this program.
Right.
2016. And when Martin did this hijacking, it was 1972, which was totally a different era when it comes to things like hijacking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, as it would be today and for what would really be since September 11th of 2001.
Right.
But a truly compelling story, a roller coaster ride, if you will, between not only just hijacking the plane, but having somebody come in and disable one of the planes and then getting another plane and then, you know, parachuting out and losing the money and getting back home. And now, you know, there he is in court where the people that want to have him put away are willing to suppress evidence or not suppress evidence because they want to put him behind bars.
Yeah. And, you know, another interesting thing about having Mac come in and do this is, you know, I was a policeman for 25 years and it's easy when you see a crime, it's easy just to dehumanize somebody and just say, well, that's the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's not me. That's not anything to do with me. But when you, and as a policeman, you would get to know people personally, and you know, for whatever reason, sometimes people commit crimes. I always say, like a big city, it ain't a big city if you don't have a little corruption. You know, it's not a really vital country if you don't if everything was good all the time, shall we say, how would you know, with no bad, how would you know it was good?
Yeah.
You know, it's just boring. So, those things, we all you guys out there like true crime, and if it wasn't for the people who commit the crimes, your life would be boring. You owe kind of a debt of gratitude to people. And another thing you find out is that people who get involved in the crimes, they're a human being. And it's easy for the system and a lot of people out there to forget that they're human being. Hell, anybody could get caught up in something like this, and given the right set of circumstances, not maybe this exact thing, but you know, how many of you out there have never done anything at all, and especially when you were young and drinking and did some stupid things, and awful lot of us did. I sure did, and to a greater or lesser extent. So I think it's important to if we can, every once in a while, have somebody come in that shows us the human side of the person that takes part in this true crime genre that we're in.
Well, I mean, you can read what they put in the court papers. You can Google search, much like Martin did, to find his own name. And there's material out there. None of it is his story.
No, nope, we got his side of it for sure.
And I think that's something that's interesting. And it takes great criminals to make great cops.
Yeah,
you know, you are really going to make people rise up to make them, you know, if you are good law enforcement people, by committing these kind of crimes. And I've said this before when we've talked about this with some of these other officers, when we talk about the mob or we talk about, you know, the sale of drugs in Kansas City.
Right.
And David, I want to say it was David Starbuck, one of those people that I said that to, where, you know, they rise up to the occasion as good officers because they have a worthy adversary. Certainly
makes it more fun when you have a worthy adversary. Well, anybody, any cop can go out and pop the dummy.
Yeah.
It's catching the guy that really plans and schemes and
thinks it out
and does that makes it difficult, but makes it rewarding too. All right, well, let's get on with this.
This is some of the material that you had that your
sister submitted.
Yes, this
is about the search of my home. And we need this on the record. The following is excerpted from a letter I received from my sister, Claire, while at Leavenworth Penitentiary on June the 28th, 1975. I'm quoting, "Good news. I was talking to a friend, Judy Hancock, in Toronto about you. She said her brother works with the FBI or CIA, and he worked on your case before they arrested you. She said that when they arrested you, that the search warrant was in Washington. Her brother called her up from Washington and said that you would be arrested about two blocks from her house. Apparently, Judy Hancock lived in Wyandotte, near me. She said the FBI knew that they didn't have a warrant before they entered the house, but they went in anyways, since they thought that your case was too big to blow. So there is complete evidence that it was an illegal search and seizure. She said she knew that they were going to arrest you 2 or 3 hours before they did. I went to Toronto June 18th to 23rd, 1975. It was great. It was our senior class trip." Unquote. I got that letter, and I said, this is it. I'm gonna go home. I'm gonna get this thing conviction reversed, and that never happened. It was never recognized. But the fact is that Judy Hancock's brother, I think his name was John Hancock, was working at the FBI. He knew all along that my house was entered illegally, and all the agents on the scene knew that there was an illegal search of the house. I wound up doing 37 years in federal prison. I was totally, totally pissed off about the way the search issue was held. And at one point, my release date was 2082. I made it out of federal prison after good conduct for 26 years. The parole board released me in January of 2010. So here I am, 6 years later, doing very well, in good health, and I'm only 72 years old, so I may live to be 102. We'll see.
We'll see.
Okay. Where else are we going to go?
So you learned your parole, I mean, your appeal had been denied in Leavenworth, and you made a statement about that. How did you feel when you learned it had been? What was your option? What were your only option left?
My only option was to escape. That was it. That, as far as going to the Supreme Court, we filed a writ in the Supreme Court, but that those are dead issues. Very rarely do they grant certiorari. I threw the opinion when I got the paper opinion. I threw it up in the air and I said, "That's it. It's time to think about escaping." And in a matter of weeks, I figured out how to beat Leavenworth Penitentiary, and I started putting that into play. But it never materialized.
Were you behind the walls up there? You weren't out at the farm.
Yeah, I was behind the walls.
They kept you behind the walls the whole time you were in.
For 37 years, I was in maximum security federal penitentiary.
Because of your particular crime, air piracy. There was no way you were going to get out to
They considered me
farm.
The worst of the worst, and I had it rough for 37 years. No question about it. But during that time, I had attacked two guards, and I was federally indicted for attacking them. But I beat those cases. You know, found not guilty, and the attorney general ordered the dismissal of one of the cases. But yeah, I had a rough time on that.
So you met a man. You met him at Leavenworth, and you started talking about escaping Leavenworth. What was
his name? At Leavenworth, during I believe it was 1975, I met Garrett Bottrap now. And he had skyjacked a plane, I think, out of New York. And we got to talking. Our cases were the same, aircraft piracy. And we discussed escaping there at Leavenworth, how we'd do it and what we would do and so forth and so on. They moved him to Marion, Illinois. And I was moved to Marion in 1976, hit the compound in about March of 1977. And got together with him, and we talked about escapes and so forth. I had initially planned to leave Marion with a bunch of other dudes, but that never materialized. The cops snapped to what was going on, and the joint was locked down. But we got together again in January.
At Miriam, then you could like meet me out in the yard. You had exercise time. You'd go out in the yard.
Yeah.
Was it a dormitory kind of a prison, or were you in individual cells?
All single cells.
All single cells. And so you were only let out certain times for jobs exercise?
Pretty much the doors opened up about 7:30, and they were opened all day until about... All day until about 8 o'clock or so forth. But, you could go anywhere in the joint.
So what did your day consist of, for example? Did you have a job at Marion?
I had a job. First job at Marion, I was in the paint shop. I worked there for a little bit, and then I got a better job. I was a orderly, corridor orderly, where I swept and mopped and buffed a corridor. And I had that job up until the time that... I was arrested on trying to escape.
Trying to escape,
in the helicopter.
So Trapnell, he was there, and
Trapnell was there, and
did you know about him? You know, I read up on him. He's kind of like a master criminal, an international kind of jewel thief, and
he is.
He's actually a pilot as well.
Master manipulator, and a pilot, and his IQ is way up there, probably 160, 170. He's a prolific writer, no question about that. And in January, he came to me. He had a woman writing him by the name of Barbara Oswald. And in January, late January, he came to me and he said, "How would you like to leave? How would you like to leave?" And I says, well of course, but how? And he says, I think we're going to leave here by a helicopter. And I said, "You're kidding me." He says, "No." I said, "Well, we're going to have to talk about this." Over the next couple of weeks, going on months, he and I used to talk about this. He said Barbara Oswald was a flight controller in the Army. She knew planes. She would be willing to get a helicopter.
Well, you were in Marion Prison. There was a yard that was big enough that you could actually land a helicopter in the yard.
Yes, you could, but... We were gonna land it between two housing units, and we were gonna do that because so many dudes, Ed Marion, would want to jump on the chopper, and we mm-hmm. couldn't have that.
Okay, so there was like housing, like one big wall around the whole thing.
Big double fence around the whole penitentiary.
And then these housing units were away from the yard, but there was enough room to land a helicopter in there.
Yes, between the units, we could have landed one between us.
Did he mention how she was going to get a helicopter? Did you have
Well, what we were going to do is we were going to pay cost to get her to become a helicopter pilot.
Oh, really?
We were going to do that. But then in May, they started to put up a tower, a guard tower, right in front of the prison. And we made a decision that we got to go forward with this now. She can grab a chopper in St. Louis and bring it in, and we're gonna go with that.
Did he scam her out of money and other women? He did these sweetheart swindles.
He was a sweetheart. He scammed a lot of women. Throughout his life, he'd marry him and leave him and so forth and so on. But when Barbara contacted him after reading his book, she read his book in November, December of 1976, 1977.
The Gray Fox or the Silver Fox or something like something
about
something.
The Fox is crazy, too.
Fox is crazy, too, yeah.
That was in Trapnell's book.
It's a heck of a book. But,
yeah. It's written by a newspaper reporter, I think.
Elliot Asenoff.
Oh, yeah, right.
Elliot Asenoff wrote it. But so she wrote him and made contact through letter, and he responded. And as a prolific writer, he was able to convince her to come in to see him. He had her put on the visiting list.
So he didn't know her before. He met her through the mail.
No, he met her through the mail.
Huh.
And when he talked to her, he duped her and scammed her, but told her, we'll get out of here, and I got a cattle ranch in Australia. I got a diamond mine that I own, and I got a estate there called Hernando's Hideaway. And he had a picture of this place. He told her all of this, and what we're going to do is have her get the plane and come into Marion with a helicopter. There were three of us at the time, me, Trapnell, and Kenny Johnson. We were going to board the chopper, and there were guns in the helicopter she had, and we would have gone out of there firing at the towers if necessary. But it would have been lickety-split, 1, 2, 3. Alan Barklage would land the chopper on the ground for less than 30 seconds, and we'd be up and away.
Did you have any idea about her plan on commandeering that helicopter, or did Trapnell just say she was going to get a helicopter? Did you think maybe they had another Confederate out there? Did you
hijack
the guy?
We knew that she was going to grab a helicopter here in St. Louis.
Okay.
And we didn't know Alan, but we didn't know about him. But yeah. She made a phone call downtown where they got choppers, and she told him that she was in real estate, and she went and looked at real estate in the area.
Okay.
She was going to get the choppers. She gave him a check for $500. With a bogus check, it bounced, of course.
That's adding insult to injury.
And
she goes, make sure this thing is topped off.
Yeah.
So Alan, after they got in the chopper and he took off, Barbara grabbed the headphones off of him and turned off the
radio.
Turned off the radio and something else that tracks flights.
Like a transponder?
Transponder, that's it. So they turned that off. And
she had a gun, right?
Yeah, she had a big gun, 44 caliber, I think it was. She told him, we're going into the Marion Federal Penitentiary, and we're going to bring out three inmates. And I don't know if she mentioned their names. She may have. But Alan Barklage, he's flying in at 5,000 feet. And this is about 6 p.m. 6 p.m. on May the 23rd, I think it was. He gets to the penitentiary, and he sees, I'm looking up, looking at the chopper,
Yeah. You guys see it come in.
You guys are know she's coming.
Your heart was beating fast then. You see that helicopter show up.
Yeah, but that we're going to talk about this. I see the chopper flying overhead, so I know they're going to fly south, and then they're going to descend to about 200 feet, and then come over the tree line into the penitentiary. Well, what happened is that they flew south, and as they turned around to come into the prison, Alan told Barbara that the door is kind of hard to open. You need to open it up in flight so these guys can jump in. As soon as Barbara leaned over with her left hand to open up the door, and Alan turned around and saw that, and her gun was in her right hand, what he did, he left control of the helicopter, turned around and grabbed that piece in her arm. That piece fired off a bullet, and it went through the windshield, the door of the chopper, blew a big hole in it. And they struggled for this gun.
Well, he's trying to fly the helicopter.
No, he wasn't flying the helicopter.
He wasn't flying the helicopter.
Like, he stepped away from the seat.
He stepped away from those controls.
I thought you had to have control, to have your hands on the controls,
Gary,
the whole time.
You're supposed to. This chopper was out of control. I mean, coming down. It's coming down. Alan grabs the gun and takes the gun from her, gets the gun out of her hand. And then Barbara says, well, that's okay. I got another one here. She reached down to grab another gun.
Yeah, that was.
And as she's doing that, Alan turned the gun around and fired. I believe he fired four times, I'm pretty sure. Boom, boom, two in the head, and boom, boom, two in the chest.
Mm.
She was dead instantly.
Yeah.
He's coming down from 2,000 feet, I think. He gets down to about 600 feet, and he regains control of this chopper. But if he had delayed that a couple more seconds, he would have been into the ground. Boom. What he said in court was that when he came to the penitentiary, I looked at all those guard towers. I made a decision right there over the penitentiary that under no circumstances would I go in there to take out anybody, because I know what guns and machine guns will do to this type of helicopter. And when he said that...
So he was more afraid of the guards shooting him down than anything.
Yes. So as he's saying that, I'm just shaking my head. We were dead in the water before we started.
Yeah, you were. What did that feel like when that helicopter started backing away and going off?
Could you hear the gunfire?
No, that happened...
farther away.
That happened at least 2 or 3 miles from where we were. Now, here's the thing that really kicks it off. He killed her, and then he still continues on to the penitentiary. Now, there's a tree line there. And when you get over the tree line, then there's a high whining sound. And at that particular point, Trapnell was sitting near the bird cage, and he could see in that area. But me and Kenny Johnson were standing next to the housing unit. And as soon as I heard that high whine, it was going, I hear that high whine. I told Kenny and Trap, I says, now, I shouted, now, move. So all the three of us started running. We were running as fast as we could, but it felt like slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
At any moment, I'm thinking that one of these guard towers is going to shoot us down. But none of the guard towers saw us. Okay?
Yeah, but back then, they would have shot you down. They might not today, but back then, they would have.
No, but you're running for that space that's between the housing units.
I gotta go several hundred feet to get into this where the chopper is supposed to come down. So we get into that area, and it's about 74 feet between the housing units. So there's enough area for that chopper, the rotor, to come in there. It's gonna fit into the spot that we're in. So we get into that area. Trapnell lays down a yellow jacket on the ground, and I'm in the middle of that jacket. I'm jumping up and down. I'm jumping up and down like this, waiting for this guy to let him know we're here, jumping up and down. And I hear the rotors of the chopper shutting down. And I look at Trap and Kenny. I says, oh, something happened here. Oh, man, this is not good. I saw the helicopter pilot in his flight suit. He's going like this to one of the towers, you know, trying to get the attention of the towers. And next thing that happens is one of the counselors runs out of the down the corridor to the building. I didn't see the counselor, but as soon as I saw that pilot in that flight suit, I said, man, we got to get back into the compound. Otherwise, we're going to be made here. Trapnell sat down, and he became catatonic. Kenny Johnson, when I turned around, Kenny was already on, up on the building. And I run to the building, and I can't get up the building. I said, Kenny, I need a hand. So he came down the, from the roof, grabbed my hand, pulled me up, and then I was able to climb up the window and get on the roof. And when we got up to the roof, then we had to go down again into an area, a closed area, and then we were able to go up again. Now, when we went up again, we were on the building. And the next move down is into the compound.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We're up on the roof, and we look out into the compound, and there was an officer there.
Uh-oh.
Watching you.
I think his name is Reinhardt. Oh, he's dead now, but he was out there, and he was going like this.
Come on back in.
I said, Kenny, we're hit.
You're done. You're done.
So we came down into the compound, and he said, come with me. Come with me, fellas. So we walked with him to the door leading into the building. Sit down there. Sit down there. And then when they got more staff there, then they put handcuffs on us and took us in the seg. And I didn't see Trapnell, but they brought him in later.
How long did you spend in segregation then?
From May the 23rd until July the 11th, I was in seg, the seg unit. So from May until July the 12th.
Okay.
And during that time...
So, couple months.
Couple months. And during that time, I had talked to Michael Marchetto. He was considered a good convict. And we explained some of these things. And as it turns out, he's a rat, and he went to the FBI and came into court and testified against us and everything.
So they didn't necessarily know that you were the ones involved with what happened with her hijacking the helicopter.
Oh, they knew.
Because Barbara had already told the pilot who she was coming to get.
Yeah, well, they knew that we're involved, and just the fact that we're involved in the case, a skyjacked chopper, we're hit. And
there weren't any other hijackers in Merriam at the time?
Not that we're out, where the helicopter was going out of the compound Trapnell.
Not outside where you were supposed to be.
Not out here on the yard.
That's what we call a lot of circumstantial evidence. When you're already in prison like that, circumstantial evidence is going to
be. We were hit.
Well, you're already convicted for two life sentences. You said, what do you have to lose?
Nothing.
Nothing. You didn't really expect to get out ever.
I life and
but you did not catch a case behind it. I heard you say that
on
right.
The chopper.
Yeah.
Oh, a big case.
Well, you.
I was convicted.
Oh, you were convicted.
Oh, yeah. Me and Trapnell and Kenny Johnson were all indicted on this. And as it came out, Beth Meadows, who delivered guns to the Lambert Field. She was eventually arrested.
And that's Barbara's daughter?
No, that's Kenny Johnson's girlfriend.
So she had delivered a carload of guns at Lambert Field when you came back in that helicopter and you were going to be able to get in that car and you were going to take off and go rob banks.
She delivered two guns. Beth Meadows delivered two guns in the mail and left them at the airport. They were never gotten.
Oh.
Because Trapnell told Barbara, forget about the guns. We don't need them. We got enough.
Okay.
So what else happened?
Well, so Barbara dies. She takes four bullets, two to the head, two to the chest. She's dead.
43 years old.
Man. And she's got two daughters?
Four daughters and a son, I think.
Wow.
She had five children. But it was tragic.
You guys are in SAG.
Yeah.
Trapnell never comes out of SAG, according to what I read.
Yeah, he didn't. He died in SAG. What is tragic about this, fellas, on May the 23rd, Barbara Oswald came to Marion to visit with him, to see him. Now, I told Trap, under no circumstances should this thing kick on the same day that she comes to visit, because her brain wouldn't be 150% active. I told him, under no circumstances. She comes to the prison, visits him, And Trap comes in about 1 o'clock and says, knocks on my cell door. That's the way people do it. I said, yeah, what's up? He said, are you ready to go? And I said, well, yeah, when? He said, tonight. It's on. I said, oh, all right. I knew he was having a visit. He's telling me that it's on. He's disregarding my specific instructions. I sat down in my bed, and I twiddled my thumbs, and I'm trying to think, how can I stop this? This can't go down. Twiddling my thumbs. You can't make any phone calls after open house. Open house went from, let's say, 11:30 to 12:30 or something like that. You couldn't make any more phone calls. That's all over. I came to the conclusion that there was no way that this thing is going to be stopped. It's going down. That evening, after chow, at 4 p.m., they usually opened up the yard at about 4 p.m. or 4:30. The yard wasn't opening. I think it was about 5 o'clock, maybe 5:15. I told Trap, I went to Trap, and I says, the yard's not opening, dude. Something may be up. They may have snapped that this thing's going down. I don't know. So within 5 or 10 minutes, the yard opened up. And at that point there, I went back to Trap, and I said, the yard's open up. Let's go, dude. We went out to the yard. We got into position. And me and Kenny and Trap, yeah, we were going to do it. When I yelled, now, move, all the people in the yard, I mean, there were maybe 100 people. They could hear this. So, and then when they see us moving, they knew something was up. But when that chopper came in and everything happened, there were a lot of people on the fence thinking that they may be able to get out of here. Something's happening. But it never happened like that. So Barbara wound up dead. We wound up in segregation. The follow-up came where Trapnell was able to convince Barbara's daughter, Robin, to grab a plane.
You know how he got in contact with her? He was in SEG. I guess send out letters and...
He sent out letters, and he put her down as a witness in the helicopter case.
Oh, okay. All right. I see.
And as a witness, he needed to interview her.
Okay.
So he had all...
That guy knew the prison system, and he knew how to work the systems.
So she was coming in there probably every day.
Okay.
And he was talking to her, and at one point he told her to flash a tit. He wanted to see her tit.
Yeah.
Now, this girl's 16, 17
Man,
years old.
That guy was stupid sick.
Yeah, he's a real real piece of shit.
Well, go ahead with that story. It's an even more amazing story than getting the mother to do this.
Yeah, he got her mother, and we had all that closing. He sent her a Rolex watch that she sold for $2,500. And we had the car in Perryville, Missouri, loaded up with clothing and guns. He had his Barbara's two daughters, Catherine and Robin, helping her.
Hmm.
And they drove a car to Perryville and
dropped it off.
Dropped the station wagon off. Then they went back to St. Louis and dropped her off, I think, at the helicopter station. There's nothing I could do about that, trying to stop it on the last day. Her daughter, Robin, she was a witness. They had the interview, and she grabbed the plane on November the 21st? I think it was November the 21st.
So really less than 6 months later.
Yeah, 6 months later, Robin's grabbing a plane over Kentucky or something and threatening to blow up the plane. They wanted to release Trapnell, and they were going to release both of us, the marshals. Marshals said if Trapnell goes, McNally goes too. But it never happened, and somebody in the government, may have been the judge or President Carter, somebody said under no circumstances are we going to release these two oddballs. They ain't going nowhere. They don't care if she blows up the plane or what. Robin... gave up about 7 or 8, 9 o'clock, and I told Trap, I said, we're hit. We ain't going anyplace. So the Bureau of Prison staff, or was it Marshals? I don't know. They took us back to the prison. I think it was the Marshals. transport marshals.
Yeah, probably transport.
Yeah. But Robin now, she went to court. The attorney general in Washington wanted to try her as an adult. And so she was tried as she was charged as an adult,
even though she was 16.
Yeah, she turned 17 by this time.
Okay.
And what happened is that she was ordered a competency evaluation, and I believe she went to the manager clinic in Kansas.
Yeah, is that where she, in Topeka. Yeah.
Some black dude boned her down. You know, fucked her. She had a black baby. You know, she was pregnant. When that stuff.
So when she that, got pregnant while she was in custody.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When she was supposed to be doing an evaluation.
Yeah, they're supposed to do an evaluation, and some black dude boned her down. So when this data got back to Judge Harold Baker, he said, oh, we got to close this case, stamp it sealed, and turn it into the juvenile courts. But we ain't going to try her, not on this stuff here. So that's what Judge Baker did. I told Judge Baker when we went to trial on this helicopter case, I told him several times, it says, the orders that you have been making here are stupid. If there's a guilty on this, I'm going to reverse the conviction. And I did. Life on myself, 75 years on myself, on life on Trapnell, and 100 years on Trapnell. That's the equivalent of four life sentences. And Trapnell died in prison, by the way.
Right, I read that.
He died from emphysema.
Huh.
But at one point in this case, Trapnell came to me and says, you know, if we plead guilty, the three of us, they'll release Beth Meadows. And I said, Trap, I'm not pleading guilty. This is going to court. And at any point in this thing, we may be able to escape, take over the marshals, so forth. But that never happened.
But you were able to beat, so you didn't never really were charged, you were charged, but were not convicted with anything related to the helicopter escape.
I was charged and convicted.
You were convicted.
Yeah.
But you got that overturned.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to give you documents here that follow up on this, and you can read these documents.
Yeah, was that an appellate in the Eighth Circuit, or what appellate?
That was in the Seventh Circuit.
Seventh Circuit. I didn't find that online. I probably could go to...
It's online.
Is it?
Yes.
I didn't find that one on the overturn.
Yes, it's
on
the
that.
Seventh Circuit.
I'll have to look that
and
one up.
It's a huge case. When we were tried on this thing, the federal public defender, David Booth was his name, in Illinois, he defended Kenny Johnson and Beth Meadows. And when this was over, I asked him if he would take my case on appeal, and he said he would. I specifically told him, don't submit anything until I approve it. He did a brief and submitted it. When I read the brief, it was frivolous. I told Chief Judge Fairchild in Chicago, trash that, put it in file 13. I'm taking over this appeal. I'll do it a pro se, and I don't need these attorneys. Well, what Fairchild did, he trashed the brief. He let me proceed pro se, but he also assigned Jenner and Block to assist me. Jenner and Block, big law firm in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Gerald Slowey took the case, and he turned it over to a young upstart criminal attorney. He was 2 years younger than me. John, I got documents here, John Mathias Jr. Now, he got on the case, and he helped me. And with his assistance, my work, his assistance, between the both of us, I worked about $2,000 on the appeal, $2,000. We reversed that thing. And as you'll see in these documents, that case changed the law in the Seventh Circuit and eventually nationwide in related to pretrial and trial publicity. Pretrial and trial publicity. But it's a huge case. And if I could go back on that helicopter case, I think I may have handled it differently.
Well, if they had those laws back when you were first charged, it might have made a difference as well, because there was so much publicity to the hijacking.
Here's the thing. If I had known the law in 1972 as I knew it in 1978, the case would have been much, much different. Between 1972 and 1978, I spent or got a lot of books on Bill Me Laters that I never paid. You know, Bill Me Later, and I'll pay you much later. But, I spent... hundreds and hundreds of dollars of my own money to buy law books.
Mm-hmm.
And I started right after I got that opinion in the hijacking case in 72. I got that opinion in 73. I spent probably $100 for fundamental legal law books, was publishing. And over the years, I studied this law and everything, and it helped me immensely.
This is from the law office of Jenner and Block in on 1 IBM Plaza in Chicago, Illinois, 60611. If you need an attorney, call them at 312-222-9350.
They're good attorneys.
If you got a lot of money.
Addressed to Mr. Martin J. McNally, who was at the time in the penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. It says here, Dear Mr. McNally, I'm enclosing the original and a few copies of the Seventh Circuit's opinion reversing your conviction on aircraft piracy and kidnapping counts and remanding your case to the district court with directions to enter a judgment of acquittal. Congratulations. The section of the opinion dealing with prejudicial publicity reflects your hard work and good thinking. If you have any questions or comments, please let me know. Good luck to you in all of your future endeavors. Yours very truly, John H. Mathis, Jr. You were released in 2010. When was that?
I was released in on January the 27th of 2010. I don't think we want to talk about that.
And you say that your sisters and brothers are the ones that went to college, but you seem very intelligent.
I'm intelligent.
I mean, if you're able to figure out the law for yourself.
Yes.
I mean, come up with these, you know, these schemes that you did that unfortunately, yeah. You know, cost you a good part of your life.
Yeah, well, I was stupid. I should have gone to work for my father.
Selling shoes.
Going to law school.
That's what Mom said, too. She said, you should have been a lawyer.
There you go.
I said, yeah, Mom.
Well, you are now, pro se.
Pro se, yeah. You were a jailhouse lawyer, weren't you?
I bet
you were popular. You probably did a lot of writs for people. And
I helped a lot of people. I helped Carlos Slater.
Oh, did you?
You know Carlos Slater?
I've heard the name. I don't know him.
He's a big drug king in Colombia. I helped him work on his case. And now he's released from prison, I'm sure.
I didn't know that.
He's released from prison. He's had his name changed. His wife came over here from Colombia and three kids or so. The federal government returned to him $8 million because of what he did in General Noriega's case.
Oh, really? He helped him out there?
He helped him out and he gave him the general. But Carlos, he was right up there with Pablo Escobar.
Oh, I know. He was big time at
one time. Billionaire. Huh. He was a billionaire. Carlos established the Southern Colombian connection. Moving cocaine from Colombia up through Cuba into the Bahamas. He bought an island.
Into Jamaica.
Yeah, Jamaica, probably. Yeah. I noticed that George Yoon, just the guy from Blow. I was told that. He was the Peckerwood.
He just got out, didn't he?
He just got out. He was a white guy that really developed all those supply routes from Colombia up into the Caribbean and South Florida and with airplanes and finally got popped. And he spent about 30 years in. He just got out.
A good friend of mine recently died, Jerry LaGuardia. And he was connected with Pablo and Carlos and all the bigwigs down there in Colombia, and he moved probably 250 loads from Colombia to the United States. He recently died. There's a book published by Richard Biggs. I got the book. Something about insanity, but. He had close to $250 million in cash. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
And the federal government got nothing of it. They couldn't locate it. But he got away with it. He died about a year ago. He was a couple months older than me.
I guess he always had money on the books when he was in the joint.
He always had money on the books. And he needed whatever he needed. But he couldn't get out of prison. F. Lee Bailey got him for... Oh, God, I think $5 million.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the head of the parole commission represented him, got $25,000 from Jerry, and didn't do a damn thing. Hurt him bad. You know, figure this guy shouldn't get out. Jerry moved close to, what are we talking about, 250 loads in his plane. We're talking about maybe a ton each, not a ton, but 1,000 pounds each load.
Yeah.
Wow.
We're talking about a lot of cocaine, and he was paid cash for each trip.
Yeah. I think we're done.
Have anything else, Gary?
I'm worn out.
I know. This has been a...
I'm worn out, too.
I'm worn out.
Are we still recorded?
Anything else where we are? I know we're audio recording. I've got this
we're
camera
audio recording?
Yeah. We've been the whole time.
And you know,
anything
I'll
else?
I'll cut this apart and put it back together. So
what else do we
is there anything else in your notepad you didn't get covered that you felt you needed to say?
I can't think of anything, but...
I can think of a lot.
Well...
Well, one of the things I think you...
Sort of going into a whole other subject. Yeah. There's a whole subject of we might want to come back and talk about life in the penitentiary.
We could do that.
Max Penitentiary. Now that would be an interesting one.
A lot of killings.
But we need to like regroup and do some studies.
A lot of killings, a lot of stabbings, guards killed, inmates killed. While I was at Leavenworth, fellas, are we still recording?
Still going. You want to shut it off?
You can keep it on. While I was at Leavenworth in 1973, I got there. And from 1973 till about 1975, I think, four or five. Not very long, maybe 2 years, two and a half years. They had more killings there than you can imagine. And convicts controlled the records office. And the convicts on the yard, they always knew when somebody came in with bad paper. And rapos, snitches... rats, whatever.
Pedophiles.
Yeah, pedophiles. You come in a child molester or a rapo, and you could be taken out. You come in on Friday, you could be taken out before Monday. These things happen. Weapons production, CMS, a lot of weapons prepared.
What's CMS?
That's CMS. That's where you have the welding shop, the electric shop, the plumbing shop and CMS. That was at Leavenworth.
Okay.
They don't have that now. You know, they closed all that down. But back in the day, production of weapons was so easy. You just stamp them out, stainless steel, stamp them out. I didn't do any of that, but you could do that.
What about mob guys? Were you ever with any mob guys?
Yeah.
Just watch that subculture kind of.
Besides Colombian ones.
There were a lot of mob guys.
I'm talking about Italian, La Cosa Nostra, you know.
I'm talking
John
about.
John Gotti was at Merriam later on, while you were there. You
know? No, I never met John Gotti, but a lot of the mob, mafioso, they were at Leavenworth. A lot of them. And there's a lot there right now. And
actually, Nick Savella was up there, I think, during the mob boss in Kansas City.
They're in some of that time. They're in Atlanta and Leavenworth. I know one that he's a youngster. I won't mention his name, but he's got, I think, four life sentences. He was a hitter for New York mob, one of them.
I guess when you get in there, Mac, you just create your life in there. That becomes your existence.
Yes.
And you just cut off everything on the outside.
You have to.
That becomes your existence.
You have to.
Did you find that you had a notoriety that when you went to Leavenworth, that people, they already knew who you were because of the crime you committed?
They called me Pirate.
This guy Pirate.
One of the guys gave me the name Pirate. He says, Pirate. So I had that handle for decades. I don't like to be called Pirate, but they did.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was great. And we'll get this edited together, and I will let you know when it's up. And
if I can help you the other way, let me know. But I got all these documents you can take with you. And if you want,
okay, yeah, I'll tell
if you want
I will.
Quote the documents on the air, you can do it.
Okay, we'll do it.
All right.
Yeah, there's that parachute document. qualified as a...
But that says the Army. I thought you were in the Navy.
That says United States, the Army. That's what it says. Gary, that's what it says. Where is that?
It's in that... it was in that pile that I had, I think.
It's in here somewhere.
It should be.
It's right next to your birth certificate. No.
Yeah. Right next to my bogus birth certificate.
You have to show that to the FBI agent that was teaching you how to... try on an airplane, put on a parachute. All right. If you have, this is the last one of this series. If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, or you have a friend, relative, employee that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, or any compulsive behavior like that, make first call your first call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. I think I'm worn out, Aaron.
Me too.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Say goodnight, Mac.
Good night.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.